3, 2, 1.
This is the No Normal Show, brought to you by BPD. This is where we leave all things status quo, traditional, old school, and boring in the dust. And instead, we celebrate the new, the powerful, the innovative, the bold, all while delivering the future to healthcare's leading brands. I'm Stephanie Rearwell, EVP of Engagement here at BPD, and I'm joined by a lovely array of guests, Desiree Duncan, VP of Health Equity Inclusion. Hello, hello, Des.
Hi. Excited to be back.
Yeah, I am so excited for this chat. We have a really exciting lineup of interesting and wild topics. And so that is why we've brought on Kate Caverneau, VP of Communications of our payer-provider practice, because there's all kinds of activity happening right now in the landscape of policy and payer movement. Hi, Kate. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I love any opportunity I get to chat with you and Des. So. Looking forward to it.
Yay.
Kate's here. Yay.
It's a party. Well, before we get into the wild stuff, the constantly shifting landscape we're living in, we want to just start with a little bit of a fun topic. You know, add a little bit of levity into this difficult world. And there's a lot that's been happening in the TV world lately, right? I think there's so many new shows premiering, lots of events happening. I am certainly glued to my screen as that escape at the end of the day from all the hard stuff. So want to hear from you all. What's keeping you glued either to your big screen or small screen? What are y'all watching? Des, do you want to jump in first?
Yeah, I mean, I just arrived at the White Lotus Thailand. Season 3 just released this past Sunday. And of course, the first episode is always kind of just setting the stage of who the characters are. It doesn't get unhinged yet. The only thing that's unhinged is Parker Posey's North Carolina accent. Not sure if it's just bad or if it's setting up for like a later plot twist around her actual like identity or something. But yeah, that's what's keeping me glued and I guess giving me joy.
Oh, that's hilarious. I also caught on to that accent, Des. And actually, I think her husband does a pretty good accent, maybe. But yeah, hers is wild. And that's my favorite. The favorite characters is that family right now. The family is just, yes, unhinged. I'm so excited for what we're going to see.
As a former North Carolinian, it's painful.
I was very curious your opinion, just given your connection, because I was like, this, I mean, each state in the South has kind of a different, you know, tinge to the Southern accent. But the North Carolina one, I was like, this feels unnerving.
She's from a part of North Carolina I've never been to. Let's just say that.
The character or Parker Posey?
Wherever the accent's coming from.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yes, yes, yes.
You know, we just had the long weekend from President's Day, and I am ashamed to say that I got sucked into Love is Blind with my sister and finished it over the long weekend. And it was a lot. Lots of feels there. I am not proud of how much television I consumed, but it's snowy, so I'll blame it on that.
Yes, no judgment here, Kate, whatsoever. I mean, we got
it. I like the concept of getting to know somebody without the, you know, physical, attractive, whatever component, but it does seem maybe a little too idealistic.
Oh.
Mm, you're making me want to watch.
Yeah, I haven't watched it since, like, I think the first season, which feels like a lifetime ago.
This is my first toe in the water of the Love is Blind series. So I was not totally sure what to expect, but it's interesting. I'll give it that.
Okay. Well, you said you're not proud, but I'm impressed. I was impressed when you said you finished it. I was like, it's incredible, because I saw it pop on to my Netflix feed and haven't even clicked play yet. So congratulations.
6, 7, 8 episodes, something like that. It's too much. Okay. Entirely too much.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm also on the White Lotus train, Des. Really excited about it. Really happy to be back into it. And I really want to go visit Thailand. Or maybe not, depending on what happens with these monkeys, which seem like they're maybe a theme. But my more embarrassing one that I've started watching is, you know, the Kardashians are back for their millionth season, and it's not good. It's not good at all. It's like they're just trying to concoct new drama. And so I don't know. It might be my exit from that embarrassing franchise. We'll see.
Do you ever wonder if it's, have you grown to a point where you just don't appreciate it? Has the content actually changed, or have you grown, right?
I love that take. Let's say that I've grown. Yeah, let's say it's me. It's all me. Yeah. I'm so much more mature now. It doesn't relate. I don't know.
I had a similar debate with someone about McDonald's food a couple of years ago, where I was just like, no, it's terrible. And it's like, no. The formula hasn't changed. Maybe your taste buds have just gotten better or something like that. And I was like, all right, point, counterpoint. I still think it's terrible. But and ingredients aren't real anymore. So I feel like the recipe has changed. But what have you?
I would love to know if the recipe changed, because those chicken nuggets when I was 5 were spot on, and they're not now. So I think the recipe has changed. I don't know. We should investigate.
It has to have. They'll never tell. They'll never tell.
It's got to be on the internet somewhere. Someone's got a video on YouTube about it, surely.
They just need to figure out the ice cream machine and why it never works. But
listen, why can I never get the McFlurry? Why is the machine always broken or being cleaned?
Always.
Like, y'all just don't want to. It's a conspiracy.
It is.
It's part of the charm. All right. Well, so with that little bit of levity behind us, we'll get into our first topic here. Last episode, we talked about the Super Bowl and, you know, our takes on it, what was good, what was bad, what was exciting, both advertising, marketing, as well as in general. And we had to do a little bit of a backtrack, because I'll take it. I said, oh, the Poppy commercial, you know, I was excited to see them there. They did an influencer play. And then, like, literally 5 hours later, boom, the internet blew up on Poppy. So just a little bit of a backtrack. So I'll just share kind of what happened, because I think it's actually a really good lesson from a marketing standpoint, and applies very much to the work that we do. So Poppy had, in addition to their commercial on the Super Bowl, they had done an influencer stunt, where they sent vending machines, hot pink vending machines, 32 of them, to social media influencers. They sent them to their house full of Poppy soda. And the goal was obviously create buzz, get influencers sharing, get people hopefully buying soda for the Super Bowl and afterwards. That seems, you know, I can see that, right? Seems like a decent idea. Well, the internet blew up. The interwebs was like, this is terrible. I can't believe you're sending vending machines to all these, quote, rich, thin, white celebrities. It could have gone to the masses. Imagine if you sent vending machines to schools, to public parks, to hospitals. Imagine what good that could have done in the world. And the internet also got together and calculated and did the math and said these cost approximately $25,000 per machine, not to mention the amount you spent on the Super Bowl commercial itself, 8, 10. I think I even saw an estimated $16 million that someone thought, you know, given production and influencers. So, oof, yikes. That's tough. What was, I think, good is the founder said lesson learned and quickly got on and filmed a video and shared it and said, okay, we hear you. Number one, there's a little fact checking. It didn't cost $25,000 per machine. But also, we hear you. And so she said, we'd like everyone to help nominate your friends, your family, teachers, locations, your community members for the machines to go to next. So, of course, the internet didn't just say, oh, everything is lovely now. They continued to pick. But thought it was an interesting lesson for a few things. Number one, is influencer marketing dead? Is it over? Are we tired of influencers? The Kardashians, right? I'm tired of the show. Are we tired of the rich? Are we over it? Are we over them getting all these special treatments? Maybe. Interesting debate. Also, how can we in marketing help the communities around us? What are we actually doing, not just to get our message out, but also help people with our message? And then thirdly, you know, a good lesson on how the founder quickly addressed it and quickly came out with a, okay, got it, heard, moving forward. So thought it was a nice, you know, just full of lessons, I think. So I'm curious. Des, I'll ask you, because I know you have, you know, you watch this space of both influencers and celebrities, and I'm curious if you're seeing a narrative shift there.
I'm just team Eat the Rich. The masses are fighting back. It was really interesting and kind of cool to see folks kind of unpack like what actually occurred. I mean, we have information, we have access to all the things now to, because news is kind of a constant. But to me, it is a great example to your point around how the founder actually addressed it. Cause so often people just like backtrack and backslide and like, you know, shovel themselves by not actually responding into another just terrible spiral. I mean, Bud Light, Adela Mulaney, anyone. And it's about like, hey, we're going to clock you on this. We're paying attention to the climate, what's going on, how energy affects, because it's all really, really ramping up, especially with AI tools. But I don't know. It's, to me, the influencer and the role that they play, we see it. It's fake. We don't want that. I know, like the royal we, right? But speaking for myself, but it is this idea of, do you even understand what's going on in the world? And I also worry about like some of the ideas and some of the big ideas that we would love for brands to do. You know, I worry that these kinds of things will hold them back from doing it or taking that risk. This is one of the few instances where I'm like, okay, we didn't vet and think everything through, but the way that they addressed it makes it feel more like, okay, I can do this. I just need to make sure that I'm checking all the boxes, kind of really understanding where the culture is and act accordingly. And Poppy did not read the room, unfortunately.
No, they did not. And it's one of those things where could they have seen it coming? I don't even know, honestly. I guess my purview is culture's moving really quickly right now. And even like all this happened within a span of 5 days, right? The stunt, the commercial, the backlash, the response, the new campaign. It's just like, whew, like you got to move quickly. You have to react quickly. And some things I think you can predict and some things you can't. Hopefully we all learn the lesson of how can we use marketing for good? But I don't think influencers are dead. I think it's just how do we use them in the right way and use them for good rather than just, you know, frivolity, I guess I would say. But also, you can't predict everything, and that's okay. How you react is really the gold. Kate, I see you nodding. I know your whole team is focused on reacting quickly. That is your job. You're a metaphorical and literal firefighter.
Yeah, I am. Yeah, I think the fact that there was no real, wasn't an apology, right? They didn't do anything wrong. But to say, oh, okay, heard, as you said, Stephanie, and to say, let's do that too. We can yes and this situation and it's going to be okay. It was a really authentic, genuine response that felt very human. I think unlike maybe the Bud Light scenario that you raised, Des, where it just felt like we're going to hold our ground or we're going to back off or, you know, any of those positions that we don't have to capitulate to the public pressure so much as acknowledge it and try to blend, right? And find the best path forward. And I thought that they did a really nice job.
Okay, we'll move to our next topic here, which actually is also a little bit about culture changes. But we want to discuss in this topic and the last one as well, what are we expecting from the upcoming administration or current administration, upcoming policy changes? There's been a lot of conversation about healthcare in the political realm in the past 3 days, month, that I think came on pretty quickly back in August. That was not happening even in the June, July timeframe of the political election and now has become one of the centerpieces of many. Certainly. One of the key, of course, headlines that we're seeing right now is that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is confirmed as Trump's health secretary. So he's officially at the helm of the Department of Health and Human Services, the HHS. And yes, there was all kinds of controversy leading up to that. Millions of dollars spent by groups opposing the nomination. Of course, the hearing that we saw, which was got very spicy, and it was very uncertain whether he would have enough senators backing him to get through, but was fully confirmed and has already made some changes. So we've already seen announcements around NIH funding cut that will directly affect innovation and research. including clinical trials and including academic medical centers that are some of them are funded by some of these grants. So there's already jobs on the line. There's already a lot happening there. The future of vaccine policy is, of course, being hotly debated because RFK Jr. has shared things in the past that show that he may be a vaccine skeptic, however, is saying out loud, we're not taking away vaccines, we just want more science. So what does that mean? I think with the what does it mean is where everyone's getting really confused and flustered. And then, of course, the CDC, you know, there were cuts made there, up to 10% happened on Friday. So it's not just about RFK Jr. It's about all the folks in play, like, you know, Dr. Oz as well, and Dr. Marty McCarry, Commissioner of the Food and Drug Association, Dr. Oz with CMS. So there's all these new folks at play. And I think the question right now is, A, how did we get here? Is MAHA real? What does it mean? B, what do we expect from a policy standpoint? We've already seen some things. And C, most importantly, from a healthcare organization standpoint, what do we do about it? So that's just a little bit of what's happened. That's not all of what's happened. It would take us all day. But I'll just pause there and see if either one of you have any, you know, what are you thinking as you've seen all this play out?
Yeah, Stephanie, you said, you know, he said, we want more science, which is really interesting coming from someone who is not a scientist and not a doctor, and to have that person questioning the science and the medical advances that we've made to date. So, you know, that's interesting, I guess. But I also maybe naively believe that people think they're doing good and they go to work every day trying to be better. And so I want to give him the benefit of the doubt that that is truly, he's coming from a good place. It's about sort of surrounding, how do we in the industry make sure that he's surrounded by the right information, quote unquote, the right people, and that the folks who have the science and who can influence the decisions and the policies are doing that, and that they're heard. And that's, I think, where we're going to have a little bit of turbulence in the coming weeks and months.
A little bit, maybe a lot, maybe some major rough air, as they say, in the skies, which is a whole nother sidebar. But anyway, but I think you have a very measured take. So I just want to build upon that. I think, you know, I look at the phrase, make America healthy again. And I'm like, that deeply resonates with me and with, you know, think about hospitals' missions. That is the mission, is to help communities be healthier. Where we disagree and where there's lots of turbulence is the how. How do we do that? And so cuts to NIH, cuts to CDC, discussions about vaccines, you know, SSRIs, you know, all of that discussion of like, should we take them off the table? Should we take weight loss drugs off the table for children? That is where all the turbulence comes into play. And so I love your point about how do we bring out the right physicians, scientists, researchers? Because what I love to look at, you know, who is surrounding Bobby Kennedy right now? It is influencers. And many of them, honestly, I've read their books, like Dr. Marty McCarry, who you know, is in charge himself, Dr. Casey Means and Callie Means, Vanni Hari. Those are folks that were literally sitting behind him in the hearings and that are his advisors. And what they say is they're looking for, you know, healthier food in this country, better school lunches, better hospital cafeteria food, by the way, nutrition, that kind of thing. None of that by itself is difficult or harmful. What is difficult is when you remove the ability to access medication and research and clinical trials. And so I love your point of let's understand who surrounds them and let's also figure out how do we also bring, you know, the researchers into that mix.
In addition to that, around like who you're keeping around, I know that we saw a lot of headlines and a lot of stories around, you know, so many folks leaving their positions at some of the federal orgs, right? And again, we don't know exactly what the conversations are, you know, what the written contracts are, like what's going on. However, there's a piece of me that thinks about the idea of the brain drain, right? And like, it's a fine balance, and it's a decision obviously you have to make, you know, personally for yourself of, okay, do I stay and like make sure that this whole thing doesn't burn down, or do I jump ship because this is completely against, you know, my values and, you know, kind of where I'm aligning. And that's a tough decision to make. And like I said, we don't know how some of these folks got there, but a part of me is more around the lines of stay in it to see what's going on. And to that point, read all the things. I mean, we have to keep ourselves informed and not just, so there is that piece of, okay, I want to believe in altruism, but then also I want to arm myself with my own facts of like what is actually kind of written about what is the plan of like a MAHA, or, you know, what we saw with Project 2025 and how that's come into life. It's just read the things, stay informed, and stay up to date.
Huge does. I think to sit passively by and wait, not a good strategy. But to be actively involved, whether that means you're working with your health association, your state association, or just at the local level and doing some scenario planning, right? What happens if X, Y, or Z? And having a game plan ready, talking with your leadership, your boards to say, hey, in the event X, here's our proposed response, so that when, if those things happen, you're not caught flat-footed and you're not in, hurry up and scramble to decide how we move forward mode. You sort of are ready for it to some degree, whatever degree you can be. I'm not saying it's fear-mongering, right? It's not like we're preparing for the apocalypse. That's not what I'm saying. But to be actively engaged in what's happening and preparing at your organization's level for how you want to address those things.
Very wise. Yes. So I'm going to build on what both of you all said. So yes, Des, I love the call to action of lean in and read what's happening. And I would also add to that, deeply understand the cultural shift. So there has been a cultural shift. And frankly, it's not new news. It's been bubbling for a decade. This idea of, you know, we've seen it since the pandemic, of science versus alternative medicine or even faith-based treatments, all those kinds of things, that has been bubbling. That's not new news. What's also not new news is this frustration with big food, big ag, big pharma, big healthcare. That's not new news. So all of that bubbling under the surface led us to this giant break that happened, I think, since August, where now it's in the forefront. And I would say, take the emotion out of it, kind of to build on what you're saying, Kate. This is really tough stuff. I just want to say out loud, this is really difficult. The idea, you know, this is very personal to healthcare organizations, these cuts that are potentially happening, the conversation around Medicaid, very deeply personal, will, if it happens the way it's starting to play out, deeply influence and impact revenue. It'll impact, it's already impacting funding. It will impact patient outcomes, either for the good or for bad. It will impact your doctor's day to day. So it's really hard to take the emotion out. But I think as of right now, how do we understand what is the cultural sea change? How did we get here? Why? And more importantly, I love your point of scenario planning, Kate. So what happens if and when Medicaid is cut? How will the funding cuts play out? How will they impact your bottom line? How will they impact your service lines? How will they impact your patient? Put all of that on paper, scenario plan without emotions, and then say, okay, where do we need to lean in and fight? And where can we lean in and collaborate? So for example, this idea of more alternative and preventative medication or medical treatments, doctors have been asking for that for a very long time, in a sense of how can we blend, you know, how do we help people lose weight, for example, while also giving them the heart treatments they need? That's an example of the blend. There might be things that you can do to collaborate while you are also bringing forward the science. And I'll just add, we've already seen many physicians come and speak in the news, you know, like Children's Hospital Trop was speaking. I think I've seen UCSF in the news. So academic medical centers are already bringing their doctors forward, which is a wonderful thing to do.
I can't help but think about, I mean, medicine is still relatively new, right? And some of the more insane practices like lobotomies, you know, they were not that long ago. So there's so much to be learned, researched, you know, figured out. And I think that's kind of where people are feeling is like, okay, in a way, I feel like we might even be behind. And or some of these alternative methods actually really worked for me more so than taking another pill. How can we incorporate more of these things? Like for me, I use, what was it, holistic chiropractic practices a little over a decade ago. And at the time, I just did it because, you know, someone in my life recommended it. And I was like, I didn't know what to expect. But 6 weeks after, it was very intense. It was like 3 days a week for like 6 weeks. And the way that the blood was actually flowing through my body was incredible. If I had just stuck with what the doctor was saying, I would have just been taking another pill. So there is this sense of, in the culture, a sense of, I feel like there is more out there that I can be having access to that I don't right now.
Yeah. And I think your point is, how do we hear people and their lived experiences and marry that with the doctor recommendations? That's what people are wanting. The problem is it could come to life in the short term as more vaccine skepticism, you know, reduction of people listening to their doctors. So it's a very difficult place to play. But I think, you know, as a marketer, our job as marketers and communicators is to first and foremost understand the culture, understand the audiences, understand why this stuff is happening, and then, you know, make sure that we're advocating on behalf of our business, which is a very difficult place to be, and on behalf of physicians. So I think just to sum it up, you know, don't mishear us. We're not saying this is, you know, sunshine and rainbows. We're saying red flag, huge red flag, fiery red flag, but stop and understand, remove the emotion, scenario plan, dig deep into this. This is maybe the most important thing happening in healthcare right now. I would say it's the most important thing, and it's going to have a major impact. And our job as marketers and communicators is to understand all the aspects of it and to help, you know, be the voice of that market.
Yeah, I think that's a huge point, Stephanie. I think the idea of just proactively articulating your value and your stance and leaning into your mission for these not-for-profit systems specifically, where we're here to serve people to the best of our ability. That's and try as best as possible to remove the politics from it. I think back to the Dobbs decision specifically, you know, 22, was it? And we were working with health systems who said, we can't say anything because we don't want to alienate half of our market, right? Okay, well, sure, I understand that from a organizational standpoint, but also the few folks who seek those services, right, we're really alienating them, and that's who we need to be focused on. So if you can put the politics to the side for half a second, how does serving the population line up with your mission, line up with whatever you're able to actually execute within your community? That's where you need to focus.
Yes. Find that Venn diagram. Right.
And speaking of like removing the politics for it, let's not forget the fact that Mitch McConnell voted against RFK Jr. as health secretary. This is based off of not his politics, but of his own lived experience as a polio survivor. And so it's looking at zoom out, look at the contextual piece of the story of like what are we saying here? What is happening? Understanding our history so that we can continue to progress and, you know, don't make some of the same mistakes, or even just knowing that, hey, this is a potential. Of course, we saw a lot of the vaccine hesitancy during COVID and, you know, where we kind of are now with various viruses kind of just bouncing around and in and out of all of our systems as we continue getting sick all the time. But it's something to be understood about, we had said earlier about who you're keeping around you, kind of reading between the lines and then really just understanding our history and that there is so much more to be discovered.
Yes, absolutely. So speaking of policy and leaning in and understanding it, we'll shift to our last topic here, which we just published on bpdhealthcare.com/insights, a blog post from our amazing comms team here, which Kate is representing, which is Things to Expect from the Second Trump Administration and the 119th Congress. And it goes into all the things you need to know around DOGE, Department of Government Efficiency, what is possibly being cut or reviewed from a healthcare standpoint, the potential policies that are coming up, executive orders, and all the orders, all of them that we've seen so far, tariffs, trans rights, and so much more. And so, you know, I would just say before we get into this, it was actually one of our clients over a dinner that we had in Las Vegas last year. She said something that really stuck with me, and it is that you have to understand policy if you're in healthcare, if you're a marketer, if you're a communications professional. You have to understand policy. You have to be looking at it. You can't shy away from it because healthcare is innately political, whether we like it or not. It is very much driven by policy. So it's a scary place to be. It's hard to read the news sometimes. It's hard to say, what do we do about this? Where are we right now? Why is this happening? Am I for or against personally? None of that really matters. The point is, this is where we are, and policy dramatically impacts and will dramatically impact every healthcare organization this year. So with that behind us, I think, Kate, you have a really interesting perspective as you work in the payer world every single day, and you're seeing how policy affects, you know, payer and provider relationships. So I'm curious from you, you know, what's top of mind for you right now as you look out into this world?
It's a little bit daunting, I'll say that. You know, you mentioned the budget cuts and what DOGE is doing, and I think Elon has already backed off the $2 trillion cut number, just recognizing that that's pretty steep. But health spending accounts for about 26% of the federal budget and is discretionary spending. So that means it doesn't have to be spent. So we've already seen pauses on Medicare, Medicaid, and maybe that was an accident or not, who knows. But I would anticipate that there will be cuts there. And we know that spending is already less than what it needs to be to cover the actual cost of care. Medicare, Medicaid actually underpay providers by about $100 billion, according to the American Hospital Association. So as you're considering your contracts, the pressure on those commercial contracts specifically becomes greater. Compound what's happening with the budget and the fact that I think the number is 10,000 Americans become Medicare eligible every single day and will continue until 2030. That gap that we're already feeling is just going to continue to widen. And the federal government is not necessarily coming to save you. So looking at those commercial contracts specifically is going to be really critical over the next year, 2 years, because that sets your trajectory for the next 3 to 5 years. And then, you know, that's speaking really broadly when you consider rural hospitals, independent hospitals who don't necessarily have the resources of some of the larger systems that maybe, you know, across multiple states, even, that's a really challenging spot for them to be in. And I think there's a ton of criticism around consolidation and what that does for quality and cost. And, you know, all of these things are just sort of compounding issues that we have to your point, Stephanie, be aware of the policies, because there are policies that are potentially governing that consolidation. But if that's your only option, right, if you don't have the policies backing the spending, I mean, it's a big, nasty web of stuff that is going to be really hard to parse apart for anybody, I think.
A nasty web of
nasty
stuff.
Nasty web of stuff.
Yes.
That's a technical term.
It is. There's the sound bite. Yeah. And I think, you know, this whole underlying theme seems to be, it's around dollars right now, and it always has been, but especially right now, you know, to your point around whether it is the commercial contracts, whether it's what the rural hospitals are going to face, whether it's the Medicaid situation, whether it's DOGE. And I'm going to refer back to something from the Joe Public retreat that we hosted in Charleston in December. Paul Keckley, healthcare economist, kicked us off and just did a, you know, let's dive into the deep end head first conversation And a lot of what he said back in December was all eyes are going to be on the dollars in every single realm in 2025 and beyond. And what that means is you have to recognize and realize, you know, that every single eye is going to be on healthcare spending costs. And yes, chasing health systems as well as pharma, as well as, you know, big food. He didn't talk about that, but, you know, we just kind of had that discussion. But it's all around where are the incentivizations happening? And so what I thought was really interesting was he said, let's be honest, is there waste in the healthcare system? Yes. You know, is sometimes C-suite pay too high? Yes. It's the hard thing to talk about. But what can you do to get ahead to recognize, okay, when we're in a situation where there are cuts happening, when there is eyeballs on us, when our financials are shared, when we're being asked for more price transparency, when we are in a negotiation, how do we be honest about that? And not saying change everything, but just recognize what's going to be under scrutiny.
And being in communication with policymakers and the young policy advisors to these different congressional folks. This is something that was really kind of eye-opening at the Shushmid conference this past year, where they were talking about so most health systems, they have policy experts within their system, but then they're also, of course, working with their state associations and, of course, the American Hospital Association on these things. And knowing that right now we need to be in constant communication with these folks, you know, not necessarily, you know, lobbying efforts, but conversations need to be had and understood. And that some of these what the message was basically at Shushmid was, you know, do not underestimate some of these young policymakers, these policy advisors, you know, because you're wanting to get to the congressperson, the senator, and what have you. They're not the ones that are writing these policies. It's these folks that have just graduated from George Washington University, Georgetown, what have you, American University in DC, and of course, I'm sure other universities across the country. But these are the folks that are really the ones that are architecting some of these things. So be in relationship and communication with them and do not belittle, because again, they are the ones writing these things and they need to understand your point of view.
That's so interesting. I had not thought of it that way. That is really interesting. Kate, I'm curious, what are you advising clients in this landscape? As you pointed out, you know, and as you kind of talked about what we're walking into from a payer standpoint, what do systems need to be thinking about as in terms of, you know, from a payer provider standpoint or communications in general? What are your recommendations?
Yeah, it's for a lot of systems really uncomfortable to talk about the finances and to talk about why healthcare is expensive. And that's not to say that we can blame the model, right? The model, we know there's a challenge with the model, and we can't just sit back and not change it because it's going to be hard. So I think to the point of like policymakers are in the process of trying to better, that's happening over here. But your ability as a health system to influence that policy is probably not as great, right, as maybe if you were the payer. So the counsel that we're providing is really about explaining your value, talking to your communities, and being clear about the services that you bring, the value, like I said, and marrying that, starting to marry that with the financial realities of bringing that value to the community. I had a great opportunity a couple months ago to tour a brand new children's hospital. It was stunning. It was every detail was thought of, from a patient experience perspective. I mean, I wouldn't wish anybody to have to spend any amount of time in a children's hospital, right? But if you're going to, this is the place to be. And as we were walking through, my payer brain was thinking they have to advocate for really strong contracts that allow this kind of technology, research, spectacular funding, right, is required to run this facility. What do you cut? where do you say to a parent, sorry, we can't afford to have that service, or to a kid, and look them in the eye and say, sorry, we don't do that here. We have to send you away. That's a really hard place to be for a health system. So explaining that value to the community, to payers, before you're ever in a negotiation, and help it, bring them in, show them around, and make that human to human connection as much as you can. At the end of the day, it's going to be business. It's going to be about dollars and cents. But if you have that relationship in place before you get to the negotiation table, it helps. And then just being really creative, I guess, about the contracts that you're looking for. Recognizing that the payer on the other side has goals that they're trying to meet, and they are not going to be the same as the goals that you are trying to meet. But how do you think differently outside the box to get to a rate structure or language that maybe is different than what you set out for, but achieves the same end result?
That is so well said, and it hits so hard. I think this is actually a good place to kind of wrap up, because your story is so beautiful, Kate, and so real, which is, okay, you know, healthcare is very expensive, and we are being looked at, yes, from payers, yes, in our contracts, yes, from DOGE around cuts. And like I said before, you know, yes, there's waste, but to your point, like, what do you cut? That is such a powerful question. And I think that's what the narrative needs to be. That's where I'll recognize the value attack, you know, which we've mentioned before. But that's really what the value attack is recommending, that our BPD POV on it, which is, how do you better share the stories of the impact you're having in communities? How do you better paint that emotional picture of when a child is sick and a parent and a family is going through this? They need all the things. All the things. They need the research behind it. They need the, you know, pharmaceutical landscape. They need the space to get healed in. They need all of the things. And so asking where cuts can be made is a very difficult and very emotional question, and yet one that we're all facing right now. So maybe we'll just wrap on that. the hard truth. Well, thank you, Kate, so much for joining us. I really, really appreciate your words of wisdom and your experience.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you, Des, as always, for sharing your viewpoints and what you're seeing here. Thanks for joining.
Yeah, love to give the kind of random tangents and hopes for a better world.
The important tangents, the important, you know, sidebars that everyone is thinking. So for everyone listening, thank you. Thank you for joining us. Let us know if you have a take on these things, what you're doing in your organizations. We would love to see you subscribe to our newsletter, the No Normal Rewind, where you can get even more behind these discussions. And also, as we mentioned, the blog, Things to Expect from the Second Trump Administration, which you can find at bpdhealthcare.com/insights/blogs. And make sure you share the show with your friends and colleagues. And until next time, don't be satisfied with the normal. There's nothing normal about what's happening right now. So we have to be willing to walk into the no normal, unafraid, unpolitical, and unemotional to the best of our abilities. And we'll talk to you next time.
3, 2, 1. Here we go.